Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off this week by discussing the missing men that returned to their teams this week. Le'Veon Bell and Odell Beckham. Then Jenny and Connor come in to break down all the news of the week. And we'll go over some over-unders for the nine teams that are in mini camp this week. And as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It is the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We're in the first of two mini camp weeks to wrap up off-season programs across the NFL. Then there's about a 5 or 6 week break before training camp start. And so the significance of this week, I don't know that it's all that significant. It's sort of a continuation of OTAs. Where it is significant is that things become mandatory this week, which means we're getting a couple of guys showing up who haven't been there. In New England, that's Tom Brady. In New York, that's Le'Veon Bell. In Cleveland, that's Odell Beckham. And obviously, the questions come up this week, how important is this? And I think in each case, it's a little bit different. Like, I look at Tom Brady in New England, and the Patriots are kind of in bonus time right now with Tom Brady. He's going to be 42 years old. I think just the fact that they have him, that they still have Brady at close to the level of Tom Brady at this point. I mean, they're well into bonus time, well into unprecedented territory. And so, you know, to me, if a guy who's been there for 20 years wants to do his own thing during the spring, that's one thing. I think Bell and Beckham situations are a little different for a couple reasons. One, I don't think what's being asked of these guys is all that crazy. And if you really want to look at the rules here, the first 5 weeks of the offseason program, these guys are only allowed to be in the facility for 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. That's 16 hours a week. Then the last 4 weeks of the program, for most of it, they're only allowed to be in the building 6 hours a day, 4 days a week. So you got a three-day weekend every weekend, and that's a max of 24 hours a week. And then you've got the mandatory mini camp, which, of course, that's 10 hours a day. So it's a little bit more. But I don't feel like the world's been being asked of these guys. And if they've got certain things during the offseason that they need to do or need to take care of, I think that's one thing. I think with Bell and Beckham, there is an element here of rubbing the team's nose in it. And not being there for anything, just to me, and I know Jenny and Connor are probably going to come in and kill me over this. Like, the optics of it, like, I just don't think I don't think you look at every single one of these as identical. Patrick Peterson's another guy who has missed most of the offseason program in Arizona. And I don't think that necessarily is a huge deal because he's a veteran player, because of the position he plays. Yeah, I look at Bell and Beckham. Both those guys are in their first years with new teams. Both those guys have instantly become either the highest paid player on the team or one of the highest paid players in the team. They've got teammates to learn. They've got new systems to learn. There are first year coaches in both places. And so, again, like, I'm not saying they needed to have perfect attendance at the offseason program. Jenny, Connor, does it feel to you a little bit like, I don't know, like, these guys are, again, like, I think that these guys knew what the narrative was going to be if they skipped this stuff, right? And so that narrative is what you would expect it to be because they've skipped that stuff. And now their teammates have had to answer for it. Their coaches have had to answer for it. I just feel like if these guys had just shown up at certain points in the offseason, like for the voluntary mini camp that they got because of, you know, because they have new coaches, you know, maybe at like a couple of the open eight OTAs, I feel like this wouldn't matter at all. And I don't know. It just feels to me like there's a little element there of, you know, rubbing the team's nose in it when you're in the circumstance that both these guys are in.
Well, Freddie Kitchens' comment, you know, that when he was asked what Odell has missed and he said the offense, I think that sort of fanned the flames a little bit, basically saying like, well, he did miss a lot. He missed all the installs. But I stand where I've always stood on this. I think, you know, guys have different programs. I don't think it's, I agree that every situation is not the same. And that's why I think it's hard to talk about them because everyone has their own reasons and their own motivations. You know, Odell gets traded and is sort of adjusting to the idea that he's playing in a different city. Maybe he needs a little bit of time to sort of wrap his head around that and get prepared to be excited for this next chapter. You know, Bell, I think he's got this training regimen that he always sticks to in South Florida. And he felt most comfortable doing that, especially coming off a season where he didn't play and probably had a little bit more work to do to get back into the shape that he wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I know, I know one of Odell's trainers fairly well, and you know, when he described to me his off-season setup in LA, I mean, he's getting more work in there than he would at like a bland mini camp practice. Like, he has quarterbacks lined up to constantly throw to him. Like, there's not a second of time where he's not doing something that's like physically tuning his body or his hands, or you know, and then there's the he's got like a private chef around the corner, and like, you know, I think that there's an element of that where you want to put yourself in the shape that you feel most comfortable in, because you're going to end up having to risk your body anyway, and so, you know, you would rather have the time to do that. But I think also there's a mental clarity issue to it, right? I mean, you don't want to go to summer school. This is summer school, basically. You know, you need time off. You need, you know, if he wants to look over, you know, the hill and see Hollywood or whatever it is in his backyard, that's great. I mean, if that calms you down, I'm all for it.
Yeah, and I get what you're saying, Connor, and like, I understand, like, these guys have, you know, these elaborate like workout programs that they like to stick to. I just don't understand why, like, just for the symbolism of showing up to the mini camp, the symbolism of maybe showing up a couple times, getting on a plane and doing that, I don't think is too much to ask when these guys have, I mean, basically a 6.5 month off season that for the most part is all theirs outside of just a few days. And so, like, when you're new in a place like that, I do think that little things like that can matter, and showing your face for your teammates can not only help, you know, I think with the group of players there, can also help a new coach in getting his program where he wants to get it.
Yeah, I don't know. I just view it a little bit as, you know, if you're a coach, if you're Freddie Kitchens and it really bothers you, then go full flamethrower. You know what I mean? Like, enough of this standing on the line and trying to play both sides.
Well, you know,
thing,
they
which every NFL coach seems. Well, then take the fine, though. If it means that much to you, you know, take the fine. Do what Tom Coughlin does and say, yeah, I hate this. This is stupid. Everyone should be here. And then take the fine, you know, and get in trouble for it. Because if it's that important, if it's that important for the person to be there, then scream at them, then trash them and make them feel bad for not being there, you know?
I mean, it's also one of several times that they will go through the offensive installs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know, and they can look at it on their iPads. They can look at it from afar. I'm not sure that any install at this point in their career is really going to be that, you know, dramatic compared to what they've had in the past.
I do think sometimes we're protective over players' free time when it just seems to me like we don't need to be. Like, it's,
I think we've just started becoming protective of players' free time
after five decades
of not being considerate of it at all.
I think there's like an overprotective, like, I don't know why all of us on the outside are so protective over players' free time. That's all. They get a lot. They get a lot more than most people. All right. We're going to go through the news now. We got our five news items for the week. We are going to add one element this week, and I think the next couple of weeks too, where we're going to go over some win total over-unders. We're going to do the nine teams that are in mini camp this week. But first, like I said, we'll go through the news. News item number one for the week, the first round and potentially only a round of interviews for the Jets GM job were conducted over the weekend, with Seattle Scott Fitterer going Friday, New Orleans' Terry Fontenot going Saturday, Philly's Joe Douglas Sunday, and Chicago's Champ Kelly Monday. Coach Adam Gase has helped run the process along with owner Christopher Johnson and Jets general counsel Jaime Alai, and has insisted the final call will be the owner's. Do you guys believe Gase when he says that this is going to be Christopher Johnson's call?
I think, you know, you can say that, but in actuality, it's got to be somebody that he wants to pair Gase with. So maybe Christopher Johnson says, okay, fine, but this is the guy, but it's got to be someone that Gase wants. And I think it would be stupid to not pair them up that way. I think at this point, you're all in with Gase. You should get someone that he can work with. Otherwise, you're just going to be stuck in the cycle again where the head coach and the general manager either hate each other or have no relationship. At least try to get a partnership that is, you know, they're friendly with each other.
I'd be a little worried too. I know it's against the rules, right? Like, but we know rule breaking happens in the NFL. If I'm not that new GM, I think I'd probably want to talk to Woody. Like, I think I'd probably want to know that Woody had some sort of input or sign off or whatever it was. Because to me, I think that if I was, for all the things that are wrong with the Jets and all the things that have gone wrong with the Jets the last 4 or 5 months, like that part of it to me would probably, if I was Joe Douglas or if I was Champ Kelly or if I was Terry Fontenot or if I was Scott Fitter, I think that that piece of it is what would bother me most, is that Woody could come back in 18 months and say you go 8-8 this year and 8-8 next year and you don't make the playoffs. But I mean, like, you could maybe you made great progress and followed your plan on the roster and got things where you wanted to get them. Woody could still come back and say, you know what, these are Christopher's guys. I'm coming in here. I'm cleaning house. I'm going to go hire Jim Harbaugh from Michigan or whoever else, and we're starting over again. Like, that would be a huge concern of mine. So I think, Connor, if I'm one of these candidates and I get an offer, I think one of the things I would seek to do, at least, find a way to get me on the phone with Woody Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a pragmatic choice, you know, certainly. But, I mean, all these guys, I mean, you know, it seems like the Jets are just like, you know, how many years were they paying John Idzik, you know, and he landed on his feet afterwards. You know, my advice to all these general managers is it's going to be fine. Just get the 5-year deal. And if you get fired because the Jets owner is a psycho and a bad owner, that's fine, because you're going to get another job. All these guys get another job unless you do something really stupid. And then you'll be back where you were before you took the job, Jets job, in the first place. Everything's fine. You're going to get paid by two different teams. It's amazing.
I don't know. GM candidates don't. I mean, you have John Dorsey and Dave Gettleman.
If John Idzik landed on his feet, which he did, you would have to do something exceptionally bad as a general manager to not land on your feet.
But it's harder to get another GM.
It's harder to get another GM job. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is you don't get, like, it's hard to become a general manager again. And so I think that that's why, if you're Joe, so like, let's just say you're Joe Douglas, right? If you're Joe Douglas and you're in Philadelphia and you know you've got Carson Wentz there and it looks like the roster is going to be in good shape for the next 2 or 3 years, like, I could see where you'd wait. I can see why George Payton in Minnesota decided to wait. Like, part of it, I think, is if you're one of these guys, you do have to understand, like, if I'm in a situation that I like, right? Like, if I'm in a situation where I think I'm going to win for the next 2 or 3 years, yeah, there are only 32 of them, but I also have to understand that I may only get one shot at it.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. But if you're a guy that knows Adam Gase well and you sort of believe in what he's trying to build, you know, maybe you have that conversation with Woody. Maybe you have a conversation with Chris. But I could also see a guy saying, hey, I think I'm going to work well with him. They have Sam Darnold. I see a good future here. I could see it both ways.
If I'm a GM candidate, I'm reading Albert Breer in the Monday Morning Quarterback, who painted Gase as a little bit of a flip-flopper. You know, so I don't want a guy that's going to stand on both sides of the fence and then make me look bad and say I made these decisions at the end of the day when they were something that he said he wanted. You know, I'm not taking it at all. I'm staying home.
Staying
right where I am.
Or staying home, cracking open a beer.
Yeah. I'm declining to interview for the Jets general manager job officially.
Connor, can we report that?
Yes.
Are we on the record here?
We're 100% on the record.
Or has turned down an opportunity to interview for the Jets general manager job.
All right. So, full disclosure, we are doing this remotely over the next few weeks. I will be in my home office. Jenny and Connor are in New York like they usually are. So that's why you can probably hear my dog in the background and why it may sound like we're in different places. We got the best producer in the business, though, Brandon, there to take care of it. We'll see what sort of magic he can work. Jenny, Connor, who wants to take news item number two?
I got it. After 3 visits over a week, free agent defensive tackle Gerald McCoy decided Monday to pick the Panthers over the Browns and Ravens. McCoy signed a 1-year deal that will assure him $7.5 million if he's on the roster week 1, with nearly another $3 million that can be earned in incentives. Meanwhile, the Bucks issued his number 93 to his replacement, Ndamukong. I don't know why I just got tongue-tied.
Ndamukong Suh.
Dun, dun, dun.
That was really embarrassing. I've said that name correctly several times, just not with a microphone in front of my face.
But that last part is my favorite part of this, that they immediately issued his number to the guy who's replacing him. And there has to be something behind that, right? Like, there has to be something that McCoy did to piss the Bruce Arians and Jason Light off. Something he said. I don't know what it was, but there has to be something there, right?
Well, because Arians was, as we talked about earlier, like, really, you know,
cavalier.
Yeah,
I would say.
Cavalier in his criticism of McCoy.
Yeah,
yeah. And I'm not saying they have to retire his number, because that doesn't happen in football, right? Like,
Palmer's in the Ring of Honor. Gerald McCoy should get the stadium named after him. Jesus.
Yeah, that's I don't know where to go with that.
Okay, so here's two things. I mean, in fairness to McCoy, he loudly disputed that. He found reporters on Twitter that were talking about him being upset that they issued Ndamukong Suh's number, and that that's why he chose to stay in Carolina so he could play the Buccaneers twice a year, or, you know, that had something to do with it. But I think it was kind of an odd decision. I don't know what any of the other offers looked like, but that the incentives in that deal, like, he would have to basically have his best sack season now to earn the full breadth of that contract, you know, and maybe he thinks he can do it because they have Dontari Poe and you know, a bunch of other talented guys on the defensive line. But that's, you're taking a big risk, I think, a little bit there.
I'm not sure that, like, the offer was, I'm not sure the money was as good as maybe it had been reported to be out there. I mean, I touched base with the Browns and the Ravens, and I'm not sure that they were at the financial point that even the Panthers were. And so, yeah, I think maybe we're getting a little bit of an idea of where the league was on McCoy. And I think part of it, too, is, you know, the fact that he's available in the middle of May, when a lot of the cap space across the league is used up. I mean, look, I think this is a good signing, because you get a guy who's going to be motivated, who's going to, like, be in a position to, like, where he wants to show his ex-team, wants to show Bruce Arians, wants to show Jason Light that he still has something left in the tank. And, he's going to a place where I think they're going to get the most out of him, because if you look at Ron Rivera's history, Jenny, like, I mean, A, he knows how to take care of veterans. We've seen that over the years. He had guys like Peanut Tillman and Thomas Davis, guys who were older there. So he knows how to take care of older players. They've also always been able to get a lot out of defensive linemen. I mean, KK Short developed there. You know, obviously, they had Charles Johnson there all those years. They just drafted Brian Burns. And so I think it's a good situation for him. If being able to stick it to the Bucs is a nice little bonus here, then great. I don't know if I really believe that there was $11 or $12 million a year on a multi-year deal on the table anywhere if he was going to take this deal, though.
Yeah, I mean, the point you made about this time of year, most of the resources are already used up. But yeah, I think it's a good a place as any. You know, there's been, like you mentioned, a lot of veterans who have gone there, been productive, and, you know, enjoyed a good chapter of their career. So it makes sense. And, you know, staying in the division. But yeah, the reports were kind of all over the map, right? It was like, okay, he was upset about the issuing of the 93 and immediately signed with the Panthers, or he liked southern cities more than Baltimore and Cleveland. It really just may have come down to that this was the best offer that he got.
Right. And I think sometimes we have face saving in these situations too, where it's like, all right, like, just because we didn't do as well as maybe we thought we were going to do, we got to sort of drum it up so it looks that way. Either way, I think he can still be an impact player. He's not what he was, but I think he can still be an impact player there in Carolina. Connor, news item number three.
Speaking to the media in Buffalo on Monday at Jim Kelly's charity golf tournament, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell raised the idea again that the preseason could be reformed, saying, "I'm not sure, talking with coaches, that four preseason games is necessary anymore to get ready for the season, to evaluate players, to develop players. There are other ways of doing that, and we've had discussions about that." yeah, I mean, if everybody's on board, like, why are we still doing this, you know? Like, the fourth preseason game is really bad. It's awful.
Yep.
It's historically bad.
And I don't think, like, I mean, I think it used to, what it used to be was like a money grab, right? Like, and it still is to a degree, but I think it used to be like, let's charge season ticket holders for 10 games when they're really, what they want is 8, right? Like, so that was the idea of it, I think, to begin with. But now the way that they've priced out games, and I haven't bought football tickets in however long because it's my job to go to the games now. But as I understand it, like, all the pricing is different from game to game, and so the preseason games are much cheaper. So my personal feeling on what they should do with the preseason, they should be creative with it. That's why I like the Rams going to Hawaii. That's why I like the idea the Packers could go to Winnipeg. So I think the one idea that I think could help here and kind of add something to the preseason and make it a little bit better is to go into markets where the NFL isn't right now. And I think that could help teams, you know, build their blueprint out, like, or build their footprint out, right? So, like, you know, say you're the Falcons, okay, let's play a game in Birmingham, Alabama. Maybe we can get some interest in the team drummed up that way. So you do that sort of thing. I think the other part of this that you could do, like, I know you guys have covered them too, so I'd be interested to hearing your take on it. I've always felt like the joint practices, when you got two teams in one place, are a much better take than the preseason games. Like, I would watch one of those joint practices like 7 out of 7 times over one of the preseason games. The one-on-ones, the drills, the, like, all the different elements that you can only see in those sorts of, in that sort of environment. I, like, to me, what the NFL could do is eliminate one or two of the preseason games and find a way to build up the joint practices, maybe put them, you know, in places where they could attract a huge crowd, put them on TV, do whatever you got to do. But if they need to, you know, like, replace the entertainment product of those one or two preseason games they want to eliminate, I actually think they've got a pretty good product there in the joint practices that maybe they could move to a bigger stage.
Yeah, that's been the trend, right? We see more teams doing the joint practices and teams playing guys less in the games. Like, Anthony Lynn said yesterday that he had studied how Sean McVay barely played their starters in the preseason to ensure they were healthy week one, and that had been successful for the Rams, and he was considering a similar approach because of that. I mean, 10 years ago, it was like you sort of knew the drill, right? The starters played a quarter in the first preseason game, a half in the second, and three quarters in the third. And that blueprint has been totally thrown out the window. Very few teams do that now. So it's been the direction of coaches for a while. And so I think it's inevitable that will affect the number of preseason games we see, because the product has just become more and more watered down because coaches think they're putting their players at unnecessary risk.
It's an objectively bad product. I mean, like, I don't know how you could watch any, even like the third preseason game. Like, to me, I don't know. Like, the only thing that I think is even remotely interesting is like, okay, like, let's look at the rookie quarterbacks, right? Like, I think it'll be interesting to watch Kyler Murray or Dwayne Haskins or Daniel Jones in that environment. Like, that's one thing that you take and, like, you say, okay, like, that's something I want to watch. The running backs, like, they're not putting their rookie running backs at risk. The linemen, I think it's probably too hard to tell, you know, what you're going to have out of your lineman, your rookie lineman at that point. The receivers, maybe you see a little something. I mean, to me, like, the only thing that I'm really interested in watching is those, you know, highly drafted quarterbacks in their first NFL action. Other than that, I don't know, Connor, is there anything that's redeeming about the games themselves?
I will say that I remember the Jets-Giants preseason game in 2010, and then I think because the Jets were on Hard Knocks, we ended up getting like a lot of clips from the booth after that. But that was the Sorgi to Cruz game where Jim Sorgi threw like 3 touchdowns to Victor Cruz. And when Victor Cruz came on the field, Mike Pettine in the Jets booth, he grabbed a roster because he thought that Victor Cruz was an option quarterback and they didn't prepare for him to defend him. And so I think like stuff like that is fun where like you see like that one or two guys develop. Like I remember when I covered the Giants, there was this wide receiver, Corey Washington, that had like 1,000 receiving yards in the preseason, and then we ended up never hearing anything from him again. But like if you're a really in-depth fan, I think that there's something that you could get excited about there, but otherwise no. And we'll get to this in the next topic because I kind of read ahead a little bit, but I think the NFL in general needs to do a better job of stopping their tendency to poke the paying fan. Like, so many of us have already made that option, made that decision to not go to these games and to watch them on television from a fan perspective because the tickets and the concessions and everything are so expensive. And I think that they should stop, like, needling the people who still go to these games for every red cent that that they can get out of them.
That game was also, I totally blanked on what I was going to say, Connor. Totally blanked.
Wasn't Cruz wearing a single digit for that game?
Yes, he was wearing three. Okay, three. I know what I was going to say. That was where the unsubstantiated rumor that Cruz had actually previously been a member of the Jets before the Giants was started, because Greg Buddle said it on the preseason television broadcast. And for years, everyone was like, wait, wasn't Cruz a member of the Jets? And he never was. But it all started from that preseason game.
That's amazing.
It really
didn't
was.
Didn't Rex at one point say he wanted, like, or he was going to claim Cruz if the Giants had waived him or something like that?
So.
Wasn't there something where Rex was taking credit for something in the aftermath of that?
Yeah, probably a little bit of revisionist history.
Right.
As then GM Mike Tannenbaum liked to say, success has many fathers, but failure an orphan.
Because that reminds me of that reminds me of Rex after I covered a Buffalo Pittsburgh preseason game, and Martavius Bryant like blew up in that game, right? Like, I think he in a half he had like seven catches for 170 yards and three touchdowns, and Rex got up there at the podium, and I think this is when his son Seth was playing at Clemson, right? And he gets up there and he's like, "Ooh boy," he's like, "If only the Jets had somebody who said something in the draft room about that Martavius Bryant kid."
Yeah.
If only, and it was just so and I think Idzik was the GM at the point at that point, and it was just like basically like Rex saying, "That was my guy. I told him to draft him. He didn't draft him. I'm not going to flat out say it, but I'm going to stand out up here and make an ass of my general manager."
One more story from that time, just since we're this is like a well that we have some stuff to dig from. I remember after that game, and then the Giants went on to I think they won the Super Bowl that year, right? That was the year before they won the Super Bowl.
That was the year before.
But Victor Cruz had like a huge season that year, and it all started in that preseason game. And Tannenbaum was being pressed as like, you know, where are these guys? You
know, where are these guys?
And Mike Tannenbaum famously said, "This roster is full of Victor Cruz stories." And someone said, "Like who?" And then there was that got a difficult pause. And then I remember he said he was a guard, Caleb Schlatteroff. Yeah.
Followed him forever. Similarly to Stephen Hill being the next Calvin Johnson.
Yeah.
These things that were said in haste in press conferences just followed these players for their careers. Yeah.
I have heard of Stephen Hill. I have not heard of Caleb Schlatteroff.
This is like a legend, Albert.
I'm shocked
that you haven't heard this story before.
We need to like incorporate Caleb Schlatteroff into future podcasts somehow. Let's see what we can do. All right, news topic number four. While at Kelly's event, Goodell also discussed the future of football in Buffalo, saying that the city must, quote, stay up with modern NFL facilities and that a new stadium will be important to ensuring the viability of the franchise long term. Quote, "I want to make sure this franchise remains stable here and continues to remain competitive." This just feels like you're doing it at Jim Kelly's event. Like, I just...
For the second time in 3 years. He did it in 2016,
yeah,
too, at the same event.
Not the first time around for this stunt.
Am I wrong to think like this isn't the venue for that? I don't know.
Well, it's none of the venue. So this is what I wrote in the morning huddle this morning, is that, you know what? Buffalo, there are certain small markets that make the NFL that still kind of keep that rustic charm to the NFL, that it's not this just ridiculous corporate glossy roadshow. And the NFL needs to do a better job of preserving these markets, almost like, you know, like a national park, to say, hey, this is what it used to look like. It was little communities. It was people that loved their team. And say what you will about Bills fans, but, you know, they outdraw the Steelers in terms of percentage of stadium filled every year, you know, and they haven't won a Super Bowl in ever, right?
Never. No. Yeah, and I don't think Bowl. Like, and yeah. I think like, to me, part of the whole branding of the NFL is, like, you don't need to be New York or LA or Chicago to win, right? Like, that's such a huge, that's a huge part of who the NFL is and who the NFL has kind of presented themselves to be. Like, Green Bay can win, right? Like, Green Bay can have a dynasty, and Green Bay can win in modern times. And Buffalo went to four straight Super Bowls, and that wouldn't happen in basketball, and that wouldn't happen in baseball. And that's what the NFL has been forever. And I'm with you, Connor. I think, like, cities like Buffalo and Green Bay, like, you go to those places, you know how, like there's just a different feel in those places. It doesn't feel like you're, like, certain NFL stadiums you go to, it feels like you're at a board meeting, right? Like, it just does. And Buffalo and Green Bay, to me, are the two that are closest, I would say, to what a college atmosphere is like. And I'm with you 100%, Connor. I think they should be doing everything they can to preserve it there. And I think that should include trying to help the team stay viable, doing everything they can to push the Pegulas to do what they need to do to keep the team there. But I don't think that needs to include antagonizing the public.
You know, I think, of course, everyone has heard that is the plan to move the stadium downtown, right, where the Pegulas have sort of built this harbor center. And
yep.
But that would take away the best part of Bills games, which is the vast parking lot where people come in their RVs, you know, more than 24 hours before the game. They're lined up, you know, Saturday mornings, they park, and they create this great tailgating atmosphere. If you put it downtown, there's simply not room for it. And that's why, you know, many NFL atmospheres are so different from college, because in college, you know, you have this stadium and you know, in the middle of open fields, at least that's how it is at Penn State, right? You know, mm-hmm. You sort of have the stadium among cornfields and these vast expanse of parking lots surrounding it. And that's what Buffalo has. If you put the stadium downtown and have some glitzy venue, that's the opposite of what the city has always been. And so I think it is a shame, you know, if that is the plan and if that's what they're trying to push it towards.
Here's what the NFL is going to become if they're not careful. I think this was 3 years ago. A friend invited me to go see the band The Eagles. You know the band The Eagles? It's like the consummate, like, old white person band, The Eagles. And so I went to go see them at Madison Square Garden. It was like a tour sponsored by Walmart. And we're in this booth, and it's just a bunch of guys in, like, quarter zip sweaters drinking Cabernet and, like, just lightly bopping to this corporate muzak, and it was just goddamn terrible. But that's what the NFL is turning into, right? There needs to be, like, you know, like, seeing the Clash at a small club, and, like, it maybe feels a little dangerous, and, like, you're getting fired up to be there, you know? I mean, that has to be, that element needs to be preserved. And, you know, but if we keep doing this, if we keep just paving over all this stuff to make these corporate friendly environments, like, this league is going to suck. It's going to be bad.
With like all the suites. I mean, coming to cover the NFL after having covered Penn State football was jarring to me in terms of the environment in stadiums.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have over 100,000 people at Beaver Stadium. You know, you have the blue band, you have the student section, you have basically just bleacher seating, right? This vast, you know, this, you know, slope of bleachers. And then covering, you know, Jets or Giants game, the atmosphere is so blah, right? You've got this gray stadium that, like, lights up different colors depending on who's playing in it. I mean, you know, Pittsburgh, Kansas City, Green Bay, Buffalo, those I would say are among the environments that you're like, okay, that feels more like college.
Right.
But it just doesn't have that same, like, special feel to it that you know, and, you know, obviously the NFL is always going to be different. And because there are the best athletes, you know, in the world competing at this high level, it will always draw people. But yeah, they're just basically pricing it out and making it into, I agree, Connor, this corporate experience where people have suites at midfield, and they have, you know, the boxes that are behind the benches, and you're sort of, you know, making it so that people don't take their kids there.
Too many, I just think too many of these stadiums have just become, like, I guess the best way to put it is TV studios, right? Like you basically are watching a game on a soundstage, and everything is set up for television. And I think there are very few places you go anymore where you go to a game and it sort of feels like a festival. And to me, like, that's totally what Buffalo is. Pittsburgh's that way with the river and the tailgating and everything there. Green Bay is that way. I think Seattle has found a way to like sort of create that a little bit, but there are very few places that are like that. And I think we've seen some places that have lost that. Like San Francisco at Candlestick was a little bit like that. They've totally lost that. You know, I'm sure I'm too young for this, but like I'm sure like the like it was totally different at the Vet than it is at the Link now in Philadelphia. It just like to me, it's like, you know, you should like if you still have that, you still have like what you were talking about, Jenny, there, that festival setting in certain places, do everything you can to provide to protect that. Okay. Jenny, Connor, who wants to take news item number 5?
I got it. The competition committee is holding conference calls on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week with the NFL's 32 coaches, with discussion expected on the pass interference review process. The league has empowered the committee to tweak the replay rules, and the committee is exploring giving coaches power over reviews on pass interference only in the final 2 minutes of halves and in overtime.
I don't know. I feel like they've already tied themselves into a knot on this. And all you got to do is look at the path that they took to get here, where the reason this was going to be in the hands of the officials in the first place was because they didn't want the Hail Marys to all be reviewed. Then, you know, they're turning around now, they're coming back and they're saying that there'd be too many stoppages if the officials have control of it. So now they're doing that, but they're taking the Hail Marys out of the equation. And I think like, it's like they're going through like every unintended consequence right now. When I think the answer is probably just to, I think the overall answer here is just to have a dedicated replay official who isn't some intern, just a dedicated replay official who's empowered up in the booth, who can call down and change obvious misses, and that's that. Unfortunately, it feels like they're so resolved to take 17 different steps to get there that they wind up putting themselves in these positions, and I think that that's where they are this week.
I mean, what if they had just said, listen, we don't have enough trained people right now to have 16 sky judges, but we will get there in 3 years. So let's keep everything as it is now and work toward over the next 3 years, building up a stable of people that were comfortable having that control in the stadium. I mean, I don't know. I would have liked that answer. Is that not a, was that not an option?
Apparently not.
I mean, I think this is just what happens. This is any time that you allow yourself to be reactionary, you know, and allow one moment to dictate a rule change. I mean, you know, look at the year, the rash of the quarterback injuries, and then how many issues we had with roughing the passer at the beginning of that year before that rule finally just quietly went away and they stopped calling it. And, you know, all this stuff has an impact on people in the game and everybody watching it. So I just think that everyone needs to stop being so reactionary and start just thinking through these things before we spend the entire offseason pinballing through some dumb rule change.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke about it last week and it sort of sticks with what I just said, but like focus on training the officials. If you have a problem, just say, okay, let's invest a little bit more money in training or in compensation or, you know, whatever. And, you know, make it so that you feel like the officials are doing a good job. It's a difficult game to call, but if you want to do extra training so that they're, you know, in a position to make fewer errors, and then if you want to work toward having a stable of sky judges, I mean, to me, that would have been a good solution. Have that coaches would feel like you're working towards something in 3 years to fix what the ailments are now, and maybe, you know, you're adding additional training to prevent, you know, egregious non-calls like the one that happened, rather than going through this tangled web of like, if this, then this. I mean, it's like a choose your own adventure type of thing, you know, like yes, no.
Love choose your own adventure.
Are you inside of 2 minutes? If yes, then take this path. If no, take this path, right? It seems like a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a web.
Are you Sean Payton? If yes, burn the entire rule book down and make it just suit your agenda. Yeah.
And I think the other part of this too, like it just feels like nobody wants to take responsibility. You know, the officials don't want the responsibility for having to stop the game 17 times inside the final 2 minutes. The coaches don't want the responsibility for having to choose which pass interference miss that they want to challenge. It's just, I don't know. At some point, it's like, it's at some point I feel like they've got to like untangle this whole thing. Like at some point I think they've got to just untangle this whole thing. And to me, if you untangle it, the conclusion you're going to come to is just to put the Sky Judge up there. All right, so as I promised earlier, we are going to wrap things up with over under win totals. We're going to put this on the record now. We've got the 9 teams that are going to be in minicamp this week. There are 23 teams in minicamp next week. We'll probably split those up over the next couple of weeks. But we're going to start with the 9 teams that are in their minicamps this week. And so what I'll do, I'm going to put the number out there. I'll go to Jenny. Jenny will go to Connor. Come back to me. We'll do over-unders here. The first one's the world champions, the Patriots. Their over-under set at 11. I think that's on the nose. Like, I think that's right where they're going to be. So I'm going to roll the dice on this one. I'm going to say that they're going to be under 11 wins. I'm going to say they go 10-6 because they've taken a step back the last couple of years in the regular season. And a big piece of that has been sort of I think last year it was like the process of figuring out who they were going to be took a little bit longer because they're a little bit older. I think with some of the older players in their roster, they're going to have to pace themselves a little bit differently. They've got a lot of guys who are over 30. They've got older guys in their secondary and the McCourty brothers and Gilmore. You know, they've got Ben Watson on offense, a guy who at least for right now looks like there's going to be somebody they're going to rely on. Obviously, Brady is going to be 42 years old. So to me, I think that like the regular season for them is going to be very, very managed. And so right now I'm going to say under, like I think they're somewhere between 10 and 12 wins. I'll go 10-6 right now. And I still think they've got a good chance to get to the Super Bowl even at 10-6.
I agree that 11 seems right on the nose, but I guess that's why these odds makers are so good at what they do. I'll go over because it's always smart to pick the over for the Patriots.
I agree. But first, let me answer it.
But first, that was a very bachelorette transition.
It was it?
The most dramatic scene in The Bachelorette is coming up next. But first,
let me answer it like someone in the NFL would answer it, because we're talking about nobody wanting to take accountability for this. If you ask someone, anybody, like an official, a commissioner, a coach for over under totals, they would say, well, the Patriots seem like a team that could certainly win 11 games, but they also might win 12. And, you know, again, they could win 10. So that would be how someone in the NFL would answer it. I would say that they're going to go over. I think that we're all saying, oh, they don't have Gronkowski, and they're starting over at receiver. But then here comes Tom, just destroying time, and they're going to win. Like they're going to go like 14-2 in the regular season. Because
wow.
You know what? I'm not going to stand there after the Super Bowl and listen to Kyle Van Noy criticize me about doubting them. I'm putting this shit to bed. Like, yeah, they're going to win the Super Bowl again. Everybody here thinks you're going to win the Super Bowl again. So let's just stop. There's no doubters. Don't use me as a crutch to propel you into the postseason. I already think you're going to win.
I think 10-6 and maybe in the Super Bowl. So 10-6 and maybe
see,
in the Super Bowl.
You just pulled it.
You just did it.
You just hedged your bets, Albert.
I just hedged my bets. See, I played both sides.
Commissioner
of it, so
be
right.
Yes, you could
so
be a
I've got
general
a chance
manager.
To be right twice. Yeah.
When is your interview is your for the Jets general manager job? Is that why you're calling in remotely, Albert? Are you
that's exactly
actually
right.
in
I'm,
Florham
I'm,
Park?
I'm not
it
actually
does look
in
like New Jersey.
I'm not going to tell you where I am.
All right. Oh, that's funny.
Okay, so I screwed that up because I actually gave my answer first.
That's
so we're going to do the way I said we were going to do it before. Browns, this is an interesting one. 9.
I'm going over. I think they'll go 10-6.
Wow.
I'm not going to say much over, but just 10-6.
Under. Yeah, I think under. I mean, when has this worked? Let's sign a bunch of superstars and they'll all figure out a way to get along. No. 7-9.
I'm going to go under. I'll say 8-8. I think the hype is a little out of control. I think sometimes we overrate skill position talent. And they do have some issues on the offensive line. They've got a completely new coaching staff. I'm going to say 8-8. Okay, the Denver Broncos are at 7.
Under.
Wow. Interesting.
You're going to go with over?
Over.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I think it's going to be a Flacco renaissance. And
okay.
Vic Fangio, Scranton guy.
Ah, so. There it is. There's the motivation.
Yep.
I'm going to go under. I think 6-10. I think Drew Locke's in the lineup by the end of the year. So I'm going to go under 7 wins. I think 6-10. The Dolphins are at 5.
You know, this is interesting because if Rosen has his renaissance, Connor, I'm going to go under, though. I mean, I think that they're really sort of, obviously, we know that they're starting over. I think maybe 4-12 makes sense for their first season.
I'm oddly going to go over because I think that in times when you don't need Ryan Fitzpatrick to be the greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL, he does. And so this is what you want to lose, right? The Dolphins, you want to tank. And Ryan Fitzpatrick is going to throw for like 4,500 yards and like 30 touchdowns this year. It's going to be amazing.
Ryan Fitzpatrick does have those, just those stretches where like last year, like was it 4 games, like 4 or 5 games for the Bucs. There was obviously the 10-win season with the Jets. But I still think the Dolphins probably wind up 4-12. I think that division's a little better than people think. Because I think Buffalo, I really believe in what Buffalo is doing. Now, whether or not they're going to eventually get to a championship level depends on what happens with Josh Allen. But I think they're going to be competitive this year. And the Jets, you look at them on paper, they should be competitive. And so I'd say under for the Dolphins, I think that they will be maybe 4-12 and in position to take the quarterback that one of the quarterbacks the top of next year's draft. Okay, the Giants, 6.
I'll go over. You know, I don't hate their offseason as much as some people do. Obviously, we've talked about the Daniel Jones situation. But, you know, Albert, you referenced earlier the Browns having some issues on the offensive line. And I agree. You know, that Zeitler trade, I think, was perhaps an underrated bad move. You know, Zeitler for Vernon, I think the Giants won that trade.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think they'll go over.
I think over. Big season for Say-Say.
Say-Say. Another, you know, Penn Stater, you know.
Yeah.
In the, you know, Scranton area is big fan of Penn Stater, so.
Connected in some way.
Northeastern Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. All this criticism of Dave Gettleman all off season, Connor, and you're taking the over?
This is a great point. Keeping him accountable.
No, that's good. In almost everything that I wrote crushing Dave Gettleman for trading Odell Beckham, I did say that I do think that the team is going to be better this year, though. I supported the Golden Tate signing. I thought that I think functionally in that offense, he's going to make that wide receiver group work. And Saquon Barkley is going to rush for like, you know, 1,800 yards this year. So I think that there's a way that they could win ugly, especially if that division log jams together again, like it has the tendency to do.
I think it's over. I think they're going to be a good competitive team. I don't think that they're much better than 7-9 because of what Connor just said, because of the division they're in. I expect the Eagles to be good. I expect the Cowboys to be good. I actually think the Redskins are going to be good too. So I think the last place team, and this is going to foreshadow something coming, but I think the last place team in that division might wind up 8-8 or 7-9. And so I think the big thing I look at with the Giants going into this year is the one thing that's just crushed them over the course of the last 5 years, I think has largely been taken care of now. They've invested a lot, like whether it's Will Hernandez, Nate Solder, Kevin Zeitler, they've invested a lot in getting the offensive line right. And I think the offensive line is going to be better, which is going to be a path for them to get a lot better. Here's another interesting one, Jets at 7.
I'll go over 8-8. Wow. I think Darnold will play well under Gase, but I just don't know who's playing cornerback for the Jets. Yeah. So,
yeah, I'm going under. I'm going 6-10.
I'm going under also. Again, it's just like all the noise. There's been a lot of noise there the last 4 or 5 months. And I always wonder with teams like that, like what happens when something goes wrong? Like what happens with the Bell-Gase relationship when there's that inevitable left-hand turn in the season? Like how are they going to react? I don't know if the foundation there is quite strong enough. The Bucks at 6.
Under. I don't have high expectations for this team.
I'm going to go over, but only because, like, this is a weird situation for me where I don't think I've ever looked at a team and said, I love this coaching staff, but I despise their quarterback situation. Like, I've never had this sort of, like, tug and pull between these two things before. But, you know, I think Bruce Arians is going to figure out a way to get done. I think I got some good mojo going on down there.
I'm going to go under. I think they're going to score a zillion points, and they're not going to be able to stop anybody. And so I think in that division, which has been one of the toughest divisions in football the last few years, the Saints should be good again. The Panthers, I think, are going to be very good. And the Falcons, I mean, I think the Falcons have a lot going for them. So I think they're going to be, like, again, like, I think this is one that the Vegas has it about right. It's six. I'll take the under just because the division that they're in is very, very strong. The Redskins at six.
Under for Washington.
Under.
Okay, so I'm going to go over.
We know.
O-H-I-O. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go over because I know you guys think it's because of Haskins. I don't know if Haskins or Case Keenum is going to start. I do think that the talent on defense is a little bit better than people give them credit for, and they've invested so much there, whether it's Daron Payne, Jonathan Allen. You know, obviously the Reuben Foster thing didn't work out, but they've still got Ryan Kerrigan over there. They signed Landon Collins, who I don't think is worth the money that he got, but is a very good player. Darius Geis coming back. Like, I just think that there's real talent on the roster, and so I don't think they're going to be a great team, but I think that they're right there with the Giants at 7 or 8 wins. So I'm going to say they go slightly over, and then the last one, the Lions at 7. Jenny, what do you got there?
Under. They have made, you know, some big additions this offseason, but I just don't. I see them as being the worst team in the NFC North.
I agree. But with a good season for Orr's favorite draft pick, TJ Hawkinson, the Hawk. You know.
Nice. Okay, so I can't say about the NFC North what I've already said about the other two divisions, right? Even though I sort of feel that way. Like, I feel like they're another one of these teams that could be the victim of the division that they're in that, like, do I think they're better than the Bears? No. Do I think they're better than the Vikings? No. Do I think they're better than the Packers? No. And with that number sitting there at 7, if I go over, that means I think that maybe the last place team in the division is going to go 8-8. And I don't think that's going to happen in the NFC North. So I'm going to say under. I'm going to say they finish, based on this right here, I'll say 6-10. The one thing that gives me pause here is that the one thing that I like, when you're picking these things at the beginning of the year, to me, you want to look at, like, teams that surprise are usually really strong on the lines of scrimmage, and the Lions have invested an awful lot on their lines of scrimmage, whether it's Trey Flowers, all the draft picks in the offensive line, Decker and Frank Ragnow, and signing Ricky Wagner in free agency. They've done so many different things on both lines of scrimmage. Generally, teams like that are, at the very least, in a lot of close games over the course of the year, and so I think they're in a position to compete. But right now, if you ask me where they are in the division, it would be fourth. And it's hard for me to say they're going to be 500, finishing fourth in that division. All right, guys. See you next week.
Sounds good.
Let's mark these down.
All right, we'll jump right into the six-pack. You guys know how this works. Every week, I put the call for questions out on Twitter. I pick six. If I pick yours, you get a like. That means I hit that little heart there on Twitter. And you get an answer here on the podcast. Question number one is from Brandon Silva. That's @Brando_Puma. With Goodell coming out and saying the amount of preseason games may be reduced, do you think that is legit or just a potential CBA bargaining chip? I don't think it has anything to do with the CBA, Brandon. We talked about it earlier. I just think that this is one of those things that is part of the NFL product that is seen as not good for the overall product. It's one of the worst products in sports if you want to look at it, the NFL preseason game. And so I think part of it is finding a way to get a better product to the consumer. I also think that it's, you know, the profitability of it because of dynamic pricing and ticketing isn't what it once was. And so I think they're trying to think creatively what they can do. I don't think it has much effect on the CBA whatsoever. Question number two from Ryan Thurman. That's @RyanPThurman. Name the biggest name player that's either traded or cut from their team by week one. Okay, so what you have to do here, you have to look at players that are coming up from a contractual standpoint and how that might play into their place in the team, different teams' cap situations. I think the obvious one to look at here is Kyle Rudolph. If he can't strike a deal with the Minnesota Vikings that'll lower his cap number a little bit, do they creatively look at ways where they might be able to get something back for him? They did draft Irv Cook. If Irv Cook comes along, could that motivate them to move Kyle Rudolph? I think Kyle Rudolph is somebody who's still in play. And then I think you have to look at players from the 2015 draft class. And so guys like Eric Armstead from the Niners, potentially Vic Beasley from the Atlanta Falcons. I don't think Leonard Williams would be on the block, but he's certainly another one who, you know, the team could look at and say maybe we're not going to re-sign him in 2020, depending on who the next general manager is. I don't think he gets traded, but the other guys I think could be in play here. All right, question number three. Can you name a few non-rookie potential breakout stars to keep an eye on, offense or defense? Well, there are going to be some veteran players that I think have a chance to make a real leap. One that I continue to have heard coming out of the spring has been Sammy Watkins in Kansas City. They could really use more production based on the uncertainty of the Tyreek Hill situation. They need an explosive playmaker. I know a lot of people are looking to Mecole Hardman, the rookie out of Georgia that they drafted. I would just keep an eye on Sammy Watkins. I think he's somebody who could come around, is a good fit for what they do in Kansas City, and have a big year if Tyreek Hill winds up being on the shelf. And then if you want to look back at the 2018 rookie class, I think you can find some names, some guys who maybe were a little quieter in year one who could become really, really good players in year two. Calvin Ridley had a nice rookie year. I think he's got star potential. Jair Alexander, the Packers corner, I think has a chance to vault himself into the category of being a top five corner in the NFL. And Marcus Davenport in New Orleans would be another one who I'd keep an eye on because, you know, injuries sort of affected his rookie year. He's healthy now, and he's got a lot of talent around him down there in New Orleans. Question number four. This is from Wendell Ferreira. That's at Wendell FP. You've written preseason games and markets without teams could be a solution. Some time ago, I interviewed Mark Waller, and he said moving preseason games is hard because of logistics. It's hard to travel at 90-plus man rosters. Do you think it's really possible to move games? I do. I think it's more difficult to move games overseas. The Rams are, you know, in essence doing that and putting a game in Hawaii. If you're going to do that, you probably have to move a piece of your training camp over to kind of keep the flow of everything proper. But I don't think that the number would be the reason why you wouldn't put a preseason game in, say, in London or in Beijing, like they were talking about doing 10 years ago, or in Berlin, or in Paris, or wherever it is internationally. The reason why you wouldn't do that is because it takes a lot of effort to put on a game over there, and if there's a huge expense to it. And so you want to make sure it's worth it from that standpoint. Also, you want to make sure that if you're going to market your game to those places where they may be in like sort of take it or leave it mode with pro football, you want to make sure you're sending a good product over there. I think that's a really important piece of it too. So I don't think it'd be that hard to move games around over here, put them in smaller markets, your Birmingham, Alabama's, your Austin, Texas's, your Albuquerque, New Mexico's, places like that. I think it'd be pretty easy to put preseason games there. These teams are traveling during the preseason anyway. If you want to get more ambitious with it, I think you just have to ask the question of, is it worth it to do it? And I think in most cases the answer would be no. Plus, you wouldn't want to send a product that isn't, you know, close to your best over to an audience that, again, may be on the fence on whether or not they're watching pro football. Question number five from Paul Spencer. That's at Spencer212. Gerald McCoy chose what is probably the least likely team to contend. In his order, Browns, Ravens, Panthers. I actually think the Panthers are going to be pretty good if Cam Newton can stay healthy. North Turner got a lot out of him last year before he got hurt. I like their offensive weapons with Christian McCaffrey and Curtis Samuel and DJ Moore coming back for year two. You know, Greg Olsen back. I like where they are from an offensive weaponry standpoint. They've got good defensive players. If it is behind the Ravens or Browns, I don't think it's much behind the Ravens or Browns. I think all three of those teams are on a fairly even plane. And to me, I think that this probably came down to My guess right now would be the money was somewhat equal, and this came down to going and playing in a familiar division. You know, you'll see some of the same offensive linemen, you'll see some of the same offenses, and you'll get a shot to get back at your old team. And so that's the way I see that. Finally, question number six is from Justin. That's at Recognize Rousey. Update on the Jets GM situation. I still think Joe Douglas is the favorite. I still think Joe Douglas gets an offer. Whether or not Joe Douglas decides to take the job, I think, is still sort of up in the air. But I still think that Joe Douglas is in the catbird seat to get that job. Everything that I heard was the interview went well. And I think that he is, you know, the right choice for them. He's the one who can kind of make them level again. I think they should do whatever it takes to get him. Whether or not they're going to be able to pull it off, we'll see. But if they can land Joe Douglas, that's, you know, absolutely a win for Christopher Johnson and for Adam Gase. Okay, appreciate you guys coming out as always. I want your feedback. We want your feedback. We want to make this your podcast. You can get me on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer. And always remember also to listen to the MMQB Monday morning podcast. That's with Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling. And as always, this podcast and Connor's other podcast, the Bad Movies Podcast, which has done Bad Football Movies Podcast, which has been excellent thus far. You can get all of us in one place now. That's the MMQB NFL Podcast feed on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. We'll see you guys then.